Talking Stuff Network, and you're listening to episode 72 of Attention Plus with Arnab Ray. Coming right up, we talk the union budget, its impact, and more with a returning guest. Also, this week on WhatsApp Geeks, news about a bug in Google Photos, a hack for Google Maps, it's not what you think, and we talk about switching from Android to iOS. And on Binge On, we look at some golden oldies from Doordarshan. So subscribe to Binge On and WhatsApp Geeks on your podcast player. And now your host, Arnab. Hey, Arnab.
Hello, Vikram.
Arnab, let me ask you, if you had to name a couple of your favorites from Doordarshan, what would they be?
So the first thing that comes to mind, again, I didn't watch Hum Log or Bunyad or any of the... The first thing I would mention would be Tamas, I think.
Yes.
Tamas on Doordarshan. And then there is, of course, Bomkesh Bakshi. So those are the two names which come straight off the bat. Then there was something called... There was, of course, Jaspal Bhatti.
In the
golden days of Doordarshan. And there was another... It could possibly have been that my standards were low, so I liked it. But there was one... Oh, yeah, of course. No, this is not because my standards were low, but Ye Jo Hai Zindagi.
Does it hold up well now? Have you had a chance to...
Pretty much. I watched a few episodes of Ye Jo Hai Zindagi. I think, yes, sometimes it is a little too slapstick, and that is true. But I think that... I think the good thing about Ye Jo Hai Zindagi was that unlike today's TV series, they talked about the common problems of those days.
Might not
be like cylinders and all stuff. They might not be big problems nowadays. But in those days, middle class problems, they were much more anchored to our daily lives than the triple K Kusum and all the other things that pass for popular entertainment on television channels nowadays. So, offhand, those are the names that come to mind.
One of my picks, though, for the Binge On podcast was Katha Sagar. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, another thing that I liked, of course, but of course I didn't see all the episodes, was Bharat Ek Khoj. Especially Vanraj Bhatia's opening sequence. The music.
Absolutely. So, do you want to tell us what we're going to be talking?
Yes. So today I have as my guest my father, Dr. Alok Ray. For those of you who haven't heard his previous podcasts before, he's been a guest twice before on this show. So my father, he's a retired professor from Indian Institute of Management, Calcutta, where he taught economics for many years. And today we are going to talk about precisely that. We actually have a specialist to talk about specialist things, something which I don't do. I talk about everything. And the only thing that I'm a specialist in, I rarely talk about. which perhaps says some more about me than anything else. So today we will be talking about the union budget. And my father will be, I have pretty much very little idea about, I was not following the union budget this time at all. So I know that currently the hottest topic in the Indian interwebs is the Delhi election, but I really have nothing to say about it. We are recording it at a time when the elections have happened, but the results haven't come out. And so we will focus on the last hot item of the interwebs, which is the union budget. And then we will transition to my father's new book. This is his second book, I think.
The first one was in economics.
So my father's written a new book, which is an autobiography, and we'll talk about that after. But first, we'll talk about the Union Budget 2020. So, Baba, what are your thoughts? I'm going to frame this question in as broad a terms as possible. But since people don't, in this day and age, people don't want to know the details, but we'll go into the details. Was it a good budget or was it a bad budget? Was it an anti-people budget? Was it a pro-poor people budget? Was it a fascist budget? Give us a label that can be hashtagged on Twitter, because that's really all that people will care for.
But should I not give it at the end?
No, you should give it at the beginning.
Okay.
So that people's minds have already been made up. So that they can go on to other things in history. That's the way opinions are formed nowadays.
So if I were a politician, and then I have to say pro-poor, anti-poor, this kind of label, then I would say, well, this is mildly, you can say, pro-poor and anti-rich.
Okay, so it's pro-poor and anti-rich, which goes exactly against the grain of what the BJP government is perceived to be. So could you elaborate a little bit? Because I felt that with the tax brackets. That's the only thing which caught my mind, was that the tax brackets, and now there are two alternative ways of evaluating your tax, which, again, for those of us in the US, that's not too revolutionary a thing, because we've always had that. I mean, you could basically take your standard deduction, or you could itemize your deductions. So you could choose not to take really any deductions and just take effectively a lower tax bracket. That's the same thing as taking a standard deduction. Or you could decide to itemize your deduction. That's what most people did, because before the Trump tax cuts came into effect, you could effectively take all taxes that you paid as part of your house, your interest, everything was itemized. So you can itemize and get much more than your standard deduction. So that was what most people did. After the Trump tax cuts, they basically capped the property tax exemptions that you can take, because most of the high property taxes are in states which do not vote for Trump. That was the reason why he did it effectively, because New York and California. But forget US. Let's come to India. Please explain to us why you said what you did.
Yeah. Usually in India, as individual taxpayers, you did not have this choice.
Right.
Okay. So you basically have one standard way of filling in your tax return. Okay. So now they're giving you a choice. Either you go for the old system, you can say, where you can avail of all the various kinds of deductions and then use the old tax rates. Other choice is that you forgo all the deductions. This is important, all the deductions. You cannot pick and choose. Okay, so you forgo all the deductions and avail of slightly lower tax rates. Not that the tax rates are drastically cut down, even that. Okay. So now, you see, for people like us, let me be very, very clear. I'm not a very high income person, but I'm not also at the lowest end. So for people like us, let's say in this middle kind of thing, yeah, I think, unless of course I do very detailed calculation, I'm not absolutely certain, but on the face of it, it seems that I will go for the deductions and I will stick to the old tax rates. Whereas for people more or less at the lowest, I mean, you can say the poorest taxpayers, particularly who do not have much spare cash to invest in certain kinds of instruments, like in order to get your so-called ATC. ATC is that you put extra money in your provident fund, or if you are already retired, then you can even put your money in the public provident fund, and you can get a fairly large amount of deduction on Indian standard, like 1.5 lakhs. Okay. And then you can have some, as a senior citizen, you can get up to 50,000 deduction on your health insurance payment. And then if you have to take a housing loan, then you can also get, I think, 1.5 lakhs or 2 lakhs, perhaps something like that. And then if you have children, then or your student tuition, etc. So there are all kinds of exemptions which one person can take. But for in order to take that, you have to have some amount of money. Otherwise, so for a really poor person who did not have much spare cash, you see, for him, it might be a better idea to go to the lower tax rates, because in any case, he was not able to use many of these exemptions.
And that's always been the case in the US tax system too. So my question is going to be that why is this particularly evil, given that that was the narrative that I got, that now it's, and I get that part, that this makes the market for tax preparation software take off in India, because now you have a decision to make and most people just cannot. I mean, it's very easy to do it with software. You just input, and that's the way H&R Block and all the other tax software work here, is that because the US tax code is like this, that you could essentially take the standard deduction. And most people who are, as you said, the poor people usually take standard deductions. Of course, poor as in American terms. But if you own a house, for instance, which most even moderately affluent Americans do, not immigrant Indians or immigrants, but most people who are, you know, second generation, they already have houses. So for them, it always makes more sense to itemize because of, you know, your property tax deductions, things like, you know, daycare and all of these things, they all qualify for itemized tax. That's why I think there's a percentage, like an overwhelming number of people itemize their tax deductions here. And this is often so egregious in the US that rich people who have very good lawyers basically take everything as tax deductions, that I think a few years ago they came up with something called an AMT, an alternative minimum tax or something, which was basically that if you're making so much amount of money and after itemization your income comes to almost nothing, then you're not going, you're basically not going to get it at that point of time. You will have to pay a lump sum in terms of the AMT, which again the Republicans have been trying to get rid of because their vote base usually takes advantage of that. So why do you think, or maybe I'm loading the question here, but do you think that this is a good move moving forward? Or does this unnecessarily complicate the tax code?
Well, it is not unnecessarily complicated because you cannot have both. So first to make the, not only that, another important thing is here. Once you take the decision, you cannot change it.
Yes, that is very different from the US. You can change it every year.
Yes. So that is another thing. I mean, that is why for people like us, it's better to stick to the old one. And then maybe at some point, if I think, from now on, my future will be different or something like that, then maybe I'll change.
So what is the rationale for, what was the rationale given by the government, if any? I don't think this government really cares for rationale, but what do you think the government, what could be a rationale for why you would be locked into this forever? It's almost as if the government is asking you to take a bet, right? So you say, you decide today, I'll never let you, change. This decision almost seems like a personal kind of the things which happen in a family. You don't think your dealings with the government would be like this. Every year you get to choose based on your financial situation what works best for you, right?
Yeah, it should be. But I'm frankly speaking, I'm not too sure. And also I have not followed, let us say, the budget speech for 2.5 hours or something, especially since I'm in US. Maybe if I were in India, I would have perhaps followed the budget
speech. But other than the income tax things, which is only, what other pro-poor things have happened?
Exactly. So this is, it can be interpreted as slightly pro-poor, as I said, because the poor taxpayers will now pay a smaller amount of tax than before, because in any case, they were not availing the exemption.
Let me interrupt you. In India, the definition of poor is usually people who don't pay income tax, right? Well, it's usually for people who are below poverty line or at poverty line. Middle class anybody is not considered poor.
But if you are a salaried person, you cannot hide your income, you see. So
I know, but in India, we usually don't consider a salaried person conventionally to be poor in generally. He automatically or she becomes middle class,
true,
right?
True.
I don't know technically, true. But
you see, let's say 2.5 lakhs is the income tax exemption limit kind of thing. So if your income is 3 lakhs...
I think you're not poor in Indian terms anymore.
Whatever it is. The point is that whether you call it poor or not, let's say in the income spectrum, you are at the relatively low end. Whether you call it poor or it doesn't matter. But say relatively poor, if you like to put it this way. So relatively poor people will have some advantage over relatively affluent people. Let me put it this way. But how significant effect it would have, because the basic rationale was not so much to help the poor people. The basic economic logic was this, that now more money will go into the hands of the poor taxpayers. Their marginal propensity to consume is higher, so they will be spending more. And now that our basic problem is shortage of aggregate demand, so there will be some boost to consumption expenditure. That is the way they're trying to sell it. Okay. In terms of economic logic. But as a byproduct, you can say this is slightly pro-poor. The other thing which is pro-poor or anti-rich is the abolition of what is called dividend distribution tax. You see, previously, any income that you got from your shares, the dividend income, mm-hmm. or from your mutual funds, the company who used to pay the dividend, they had to deduct tax at the rate of some 20% there. But after I receive it as a shareholder, I don't have to pay any tax previously.
Okay.
So in that sense, you can say rich, poor, everybody is paying a uniform tax of 20%.
Okay.
Right? But now that has been changed. So there will be no dividend distribution tax at the source. It will all accrue to the person. And depending on his tax slab, he will pay the corresponding tax rate. So if you are a poor, then we might have to pay 5% or 10%, whereas Ambani might have to pay 40% or something like that. So that makes a difference.
Okay. So one of the problems that this government, you know, and this is not made up, this is true, is, you know, the fall in GDP growth, right?
Yes.
And also, I think it's, in who's responsible for it, we can split hairs on it, but the liquidity problem.
Yes.
So what does this liquidity problem, you know, basically means there's not enough money to loan to people. And if you don't loan stuff, businesses don't grow because businesses don't work like people, that they, you know, basically expend from their savings or their income. They obviously have to borrow money in order to even carry on their daily operations. That's just the way business is. So if credit is not readily available, that basically means businesses will fold up. So given that these two things have been kind of touted as two of the biggest failings of this current government, do you think the government has done something, or pretty sure it has done something, but do you think it's enough?
Yeah, let me go to a couple of basics here,
okay,
of economics. See, so one of the basic problems is that our aggregate demand is not growing fast enough. Okay.
Okay.
And this is really a demand determined kind of GDP, so, rather than a supply determined GDP.
So aggregate demand, by that you mean that people are just not spending enough money.
Yeah, exactly.
To buy stuff.
Yeah. Aggregate demand has a few components.
Okay.
One is consumption expenditure.
Mm-hmm.
Other is investment expenditure. Third is government expenditure. And the fourth is what is called net exports. Exports minus imports.
Okay.
So these are the major components. So if we have to boost the aggregate demand, some or all of this will have to be lifted up.
Okay.
That's the basic logic. Now, regarding consumption, the government is saying, well, we're giving this income tax exemption, some more money will go to the poor person. Because in any case, the government is saying that government will forgo some tax revenue, which basically means that somebody will be gaining this tax revenue.
Yes.
Okay. And they will be spending a part of it. So that is one way in which they think that there will be some increase in consumption expenditure.
Okay.
And there's another component. They're saying that in terms of budgetary allocation, they're putting more money in the rural sector.
Okay.
So, and there is a belief that the rural people are poorer people.
Okay. I mean, that's...
And therefore, their marginal propensity to consume is higher. Therefore, if more money is redistributed towards them, again, there will be some rise in aggregate consumption expenditure. So these are the two planks on which they're trying to raise consumption expenditure to some extent. Next, come to investment expenditure, private investment expenditure. Here, the basic problem is that there is so much of excess capacity almost everywhere.
What do you mean by excess capacity?
Excess capacity
for those?
Means you already have your production capacity, and it is not being utilized. Say there is only 70% utilization, so 30% excess capacity. So even if there is some increase in demand, you don't need to add to your production capacity. Therefore, no need to invest, so to say.
Sure.
Because in economic terms, investment does not mean buying old shares. Yeah. It means addition to new plants, new businesses,
sure,
and all that.
So if you can sell one more unit, you're going to get much more profit because you don't have to invest to scale up.
Yes, exactly.
Anymore.
So you don't have to expand your production plant or anything like that. Therefore, in real terms, there is no need to add to investment expenditure. That's why even if you give tax concessions to corporates, it's not going to solve the problem. If I have excess capacity, even if you reduce your interest rate, you see, still if I have to pay, say, 2% interest or whatever it is, why should I borrow money and pay 2% interest? I don't need to add to investment expenditure. But all the time say reduce interest rates, because reduce interest rates increases your profits after interest payments and tax payments. So business would always say, oh, our major problem is that, oh, interest rates are so high, tax rates are so high, reduce them. But in terms of economic logic, if you cut your tax rates or if you cut your interest rates under the prevailing circumstances, it's not going to help to boost private investment expenditure to any significant extent. Okay. So there's really nothing much that this government or any government can do to raise private investment expenditure at this point of time.
Okay.
So now comes...
Just a second. Let me just interrupt you for a second. Vikram, did you say anything?
I wanted to ask him. See, the budget, I mean, ever since I remember, we have this annual, you know, budget, and it's a planning jamboree where all of us look forward to it, saying what is the government going to dole out. So my question is this kind of approach still relevant? I mean, I had asked Arnab this last year, whether the US makes such a big deal about its budget. And if I remember, Arnab, you said, no, things like this just it's business as usual. So in India, why is the budget still such a such a media event, something that especially the middle class look forward to? And is this the way it should be?
Okay, we'll come back to that. Let's first finish this thing on this question on, and because I'm interested in to understand whether, given the problems that have been identified, especially with respect to liquidity, does this budget do anything for it?
Okay. But let us go back to where I...
Expenditure, yes.
So the next thing is government expenditure.
Okay. Now,
this is something which in the hands of the government, you can say.
Sure.
And there was a general expectation that government will go for infrastructure investment.
So basically pay people to dig holes and then...
Not necessarily.
Better
not to dig holes, but build roads.
Stimulus package.
Yes. Airports, ports, sure. Highways kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Digging holes is the extreme.
I know, but... But it's
metaphor kind of thing.
Yes.
But anyway, yes. So this government, but in order to do that, given that again, the tax collections are very low this year. So there is a big problem there.
And why are tax collections low?
Yeah. Because you see, the moment growth rate slows down, automatically your tax revenue goes down.
Sure.
Okay. And actually, it is a more than a proportionate effect because it's a progressive.
Is this because of GST?
Yeah. GST is one part of it. Yeah. Yes. But apart from that, even your income tax collection, profit, because you see, everything is squeezed.
Okay. Yeah.
Given that incomes are squeezed, obviously the taxes on income, whatever it is, business income, or that will also be squeezed. GST is also one part of the problem, because there are lots of issues about GST which still have not been really resolved. So you can still talk about teething troubles, but it's still continuing. But anyway, but the tax collections are far below what was projected. And therefore, any increase in government expenditure will mean that government's deficit will increase.
Of course.
Now, you can say, most economists would say that in this kind of situation,
deficits are
better to have more deficit. That is the so-called Keynesian economics.
Yes.
Almost everyone nowadays, you see, economists of any color, so to say, would say, yes, that's a good idea. But only practical problem is that you have your international credit rating agencies and they often look at your fiscal deficit thing. Yeah. The moment your fiscal deficit increases, sometimes your sovereign credit rating is reduced.
Okay.
Rightly or wrongly? So, but that has an effect, because you see, some of the foreign money which comes in, particularly the institutional investors, they are under legal obligations that in order to manage their portfolios,
yes,
they will have to have a certain percentage of thing only in, say, A plus plus securities or A minus, like this. So the moment your credit rating goes down, that means their weight to India kind of fund also goes down.
Yes.
So that is something which the government has to keep in mind.
Sure.
Whether rational, irrational, that's my thing. That's one thing. But again, here, most economists are arguing, myself included, that credit rating agencies are not fools. Okay. So
they aren't? I thought they were.
No.
I thought that the 2008 crisis established that they were fools.
They make mistakes, but not this
And kind. Malicious mistakes, yeah, that were proven.
But in this particular case, I think they more or less understand that India's real problem is growth slowdown. You see, therefore, the return on investment basically depends on actually your growth rate and all that. Yeah. So reduction in interest rates or fiscal deficit or tax rates, those things are of secondary importance. The main thing, if by running a fiscal deficit, you can really lift up the growth rate, that is much better for investors than anything else. So now generally economists believe that international credit rating agencies also have economists and all that. They understand, unless it's a runaway kind of thing. Okay. So, yes, you can relax your fiscal deficit target to some extent, but not very much. And that is what they have done. You see, the fiscal deficit target was roughly 3.3. So they have increased it from 3.3 to 3.8. However, again, there is a lot of sleight of hand which goes there in terms of calculation. So even if you take into account, because you can say, you can do a lot of fudging here. Uh-huh. But even if you take into account this fudging, etc., the worst case scenario is that it will be not more than 4.8%. I've seen all kinds of estimates made by people. So that is not too much. It is not a runaway kind of thing. And the economic policy advisors, they are also saying it, trying to emphasize this point, that yes, we are going for fiscal stimulus, but we know that your financial stability, macro stability is of utmost importance. Therefore, even if we relax it a little bit, we'll not relax it too much. So don't worry. So given all the constraints, etc., you can say there is really nothing much that this government could have done except what it has done, roughly speaking. Okay, but you can say, what will be the immediate, will there be an immediate effect on growth? Answer is no. Because even if you, they have increased some infrastructure investment, but you see what kind of things? They will put it up, new airports, they build new roads, all these things
take time. Yes.
And these things take time. You have to have the projects, and then you know that
there'll be corruption and people.
Not only that, in India, there's a huge problem of land acquisition, is a big problem.
Yes.
Okay? There are political opposition immediately. Okay.
I mean, for roads, I would say. Not for airports. I mean, they're already there, right?
No, but even an expansion of airports, there's all kinds of problems. And now there will be the question of pollution, the environmental clearance would be a problem the moment you try to expand or open a second airport or something like that. Or there will be a lot of sound pollution or this, that. And nowadays, you see, one political party, whatever political party is out of power, all the time say, this is a very bad kind of thing. So all these things, if you take that into account, it will take years, even if these things take...
So if this was a Congress government, do you think the budget would have been any different?
I don't think so. Possibly they would package it in a slightly different way or whatever it is, but roughly, given the constraints, nothing much could have been really done. And general consensus is that in the short run, this is roughly neutral with respect to growth and inflation. So it will not produce much effect in the short term, means next 1 year or maybe 1.5 years, 2 years. But you basically have to focus on continuing an economic reforms kind of thing.
Okay, I have a question because I hear this always on television that the government has not done, exactly, the government has not done structural reforms. I just want to understand what are these hypothetical and never mentioned structural reforms that the government apparently never does, but should?
Here, basically people, or at least the economists, when they talk about, they say reforms in the land market, labor market, capital market, and energy market. These are the four things they often talk about.
And what are those things?
Land, you see, the land acquisition issues, etc. And once this government, when it first took into it, they tried to change some of these laws, the land acquisition laws, etc. But there was a huge kind of opposition, etc. So again, that's why, even though in abstract you can say these are the kinds of reform that we need, in basically to get it through on the ground is very difficult given our kind of chaotic democracy and all that. Mm-hmm. So similarly about labor reforms. Labor reforms means, you see, firing should be made easier. You'll have to...
Wait, hold on. So you're saying that the structural reforms that people who are aligned with the Congress and the left are suggesting is that we should fire more people, is that labor laws are too strong in this country and we should actually have... Unions are too powerful, effectively, and we should have more, let's say, anti-union laws. Is that what you're saying?
Possibly.
That's shocking.
Possibly Congress people will not say that. But you see, again, the point is that the Congress party may not say that. But it's some of the economists who are, you can say, the intellectuals.
I mean, Chidambaram.
Chidambaram is a politician. Chidambaram is not an economist. So let's forget about that.
But he's been presenting the...
He's the
finance minister.
But if you pay more attention to what Sir Manmohan Singh says,
okay,
in his own ways, sometimes very difficult.
Manmohan Singh is saying that our labor laws are too pro-labor?
What do we say? Or let's put it this way. Say, ask Kaushik Basu.
Okay, but he hates Modi, so I'm pretty sure.
No, different. But while he was the advisor to UPA government, yes, he did talk about all these kind of labor reforms.
But then, since now he is not, and since Modi is in power, if Modi does that, he will say this is a terrible thing.
He might say that, but I'm still not sure. For example, if since you're coming to that, let's take Abhijit Banerjee. Abhijit Banerjee is being labeled as a left economist.
Abhijit Banerjee is like the sequel to Amartya Sen now.
Okay, yeah, whatever it is. But he is considered and a presentative of the left economist, right? But in terms of his interviews, just we did after Nobel, I mean, he said that government jobs all should be on a probationary basis, because one of the major problems is that people don't work there because absolute job security. You not have this absolute kind of job security. No,
that's a Bengali in him speaking, because he's seen that growing up. So I'm guessing that.
Whatever. Not only that. So he thinks that there should be maybe a 3-year appointment or something like that, and then it should be reviewed kind of thing. And this thing, because of this permanency, that's why there is so much of rush for even MBAs, engineers, everything to get some kind of government job. Because what is this? Not so much that the money is great, but I don't have to do anything.
Okay, so moving on. So the structural labor reforms that all of them are talking about, to summarize, is essentially saying that the labor laws as they are, not laws, but let's say the labor culture as it is in the country, needs toughening, rather than the other way around. Rather than saying that we are a uber capitalist society, which is what we are told.
It's a little bit more nuanced than this. Let me put it this way. What they're saying is that because of this, say, business cycle or whatever it is, and technological changes, you see, some industries will go down, some industries will go up, some firms will go all the time. This kind of churn will all take place. So even if jobs are created in some sectors, there will be job loss in others. Okay. So the point is that, and for that, you will have to let people to fire, but you see, there should be far better compensation package for the people who are being fired. Also, you should allow more contract workers to be used, but the quality of, you can say, the working conditions, the salary structure, etc., maybe.
But that will never happen. In Indian government, if Indian government hires a contractor, after 5 years, they will say, you have to make us permanent. Right, and that always gets media favor. That this guy has been working as a contractor for 20 years, he has to become now permanent, which basically means that I'm going to do the exact same thing, and I cannot be fired anymore. Right, with a contractor, there is at least that nominal thing that, which obviously, of course, doesn't happen.
No, actually, you're talking about basically legislation. Now, there are two things. One, listen, even in terms of legislation, sometimes it is very difficult to fire people. So one is that to at least change the legislation. Then, of course, even after there is legislation, legally you can fire people, but still you may not be able to do it because of political reasons. That's a different thing. But even legally nowadays, there are lots of obstacles that if you are employing more than 100 people or something like that, then you have to seek government permission, even if it fire even a single person. But obviously, no government will give you permission for that, you see.
This is craziness. This is, again, I'm pretty sure is a legacy from the from our red tape Congress past, that, you know, if you those days you have to ask for government permission to import machinery, expand, start a new factory, everything had to go to the government.
Yeah, but the real problem is with the Indian democracy is this, that whenever the political party is in power, they'll be saying something. But the moment the same party, this is true about Congress, it's true about BJP, the moment it goes to the opposition, we'll be opposing all these things again.
That is because we don't have an economic right in this country. We have a social right and we have a social left, but everybody is economic left in this country.
Okay, anyway.
And what are the other two structural reform domains that you talked about?
Okay. Other thing is, they say even the interest rate, they will say real interest rate, because
with inflation,
interest rate minus inflation rate is relatively high in India compared to countries like China or many other countries. So business people are at a disadvantage. And then also in the energy cost, etc., we are in trouble. And then there are, of course, the other things that the red tape, in order to start a business, in order to conduct a business, you have to get so many...
Energy cost?
No. Energy cost is one thing.
Kejriwal says energy should be free. That's a human right.
That's again for I think at an individual level. I'm not saying that they're saying that this will be free for all business firms. I don't think so. Up will not be saying that. then will be pro rich. So
yes, but again, this is another topic. But Up is effectively a pro rich party, which disguises itself as pro-poor.
Anyway,
but anyways, it's an interesting strategy, and I think it's going to pay them rich dividends in the Delhi election. But go on, which is the fourth?
Yeah. I'm basically saying what the economists are saying, rather than what political parties are saying. So many economists think also that our energy costs are high and there is so much of rate. Because you see, the corruption, rate tapism, all these have costs. They have monetary costs for the business.
Sure.
So given all these things, you see, Indian business is not internationally competitive. That is why we cannot export also.
But these are almost impossible problems to solve. To say that the government, as wise men on TV said, we need to have structural reforms. Yes. I mean, how can anybody, and not saying you, can anybody solve these problems?
Yes. Now, the thing is this. People will say, well, say 3 years back, at least we are growing at 7% growth rate, even with all these kinds of things, right?
Okay.
Therefore, something new had happened.
What happened?
Yeah, exactly. That is where opinions differ. Let me take a couple of minutes here.
Okay.
One, some people would say the proximate reason is that actually this bad debt issue about the banks, and then it has spread to non-banking financial companies, and also we call it the triple balance sheet problem, that bad debt for banks, for non-banking finance companies, and corporates. So for all these reasons taken together is one of the immediate or the proximate cause for the slowdown. It's not so much the structural things, because the structural problems have been always there. Still, we grew.
That sounds logical.
Okay, that sounds logical. Another thing which, say, another group of economists say, since what Abhijit Banerjee says nowadays assumes a great significance because
of course
he's a Nobel laureate. Okay, so what Abhijit and Duflo, I mean, their line of thinking is that we have to accept the relatively low growth rate as the new normal. Whatever you do, you will not be able to step it up to 7-8%. Whatever you may say, this is the same reason why China is slowing down. This is what, in economics, is called middle income trap. That after the income goes to a certain level, now where exactly it will be, not always very clear. But you see, if you take Japan, you see, you grow at a relatively fast rate for 2.5 to 3 decades, and then it slows down.
It's exactly like a balloon, right? You know, it obviously expands much faster initially.
There is also a reason, because you had the license permitrage and all that. There's a huge inefficiency in the system. Now, the efficiency gains have more or less been exhausted.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course.
The better firms have taken over, the older firms have gone down. Whatever better technologies you can adopt, you have already adopted. But now, any kind of progress will be very incremental kind of
okay.
thing. So you accept better that this maybe 5%, may not be 6%, is the new normal. So let's not try too much on, not put too much focus on trying to step up the growth rate, but rather have more emphasis on improving the quality of life of people, et cetera, assuming that 5-6% is the normal. So focus government's energy on those things, because China will also accepting it. Many other countries will also accept it. Actually, the best bet for India in that sense, particularly for Modi government, would be if the rest of the global economy also slows down, China also slows down, and this coronavirus would come to Modi's rescue, because the Chinese growth rate might go down by 1 percentage point or something like that.
Because supply chain disruption has been enormous.
Everything. So it is quite possible that next year, if India can grow up to say 6% or so, it's quite possible that Chinese growth rate will be 6% or less. So you can say, India is the fastest growing big economy in the world, even after all these things. So possibly that is what is going to happen.
Okay.
But as I said, in the very short run, there is really nothing in the budget to boost the growth rate, etc. But that is why they're saying that we should not actually lose our grip on our fiscal balance and macro stability, etc. Because those things are far more important in the longer run than a quick fiscal stimulus kind of thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So this is roughly
okay. the situation. Is. So the last question was what basically Vikram raised. Do you think that in general, because other countries, because at least in the US, there's no one day in which the fiscal policy of the US is decided, comes out. The only big thing that happens in the US is a State of the Union, which is a political speech given by the president where he says, I'm amazing. Every president says that.
Yeah.
But there is no really policy. There's economic policy is kind of distributed throughout the year.
Frankly speaking, that is also gradually happening in India, but people's mindset is not changing, particularly the media and all that. They still think the budget is so. Budget is not that important anymore.
No, because in my days, it used to be like tax on kumkum has gone up.
Exactly. But that is no longer the case. Not a matter of fact, this huge reduction in corporate tax rates from 25% to 15% is announced much before the budget. So lots of things nowadays are announced outside the budget. You see, but still people think that there are a lot of policy announcements will be made in the budget, but actually no major policy announcement nowadays is made in the budget. So actually, should not pay that much attention to the budget anymore.
That's interesting to see that budget, because at least in the US, I guess, I don't know how it is, that is the Fed, it's the federal, it's the yes. Fed with the interest rate cuts, interest rate, yeah. which have the most impact yes. in terms of common people's lives, because the interest you're getting in your bank, we're getting on your CDs, which is what they call fixed deposits, those are all tied that, to the Fed rate.
Your housing loan,
etc. Housing loan. So people then decide to refinance. So people's finances in the US are basically determined purely by the Fed's interest rates.
In fact, even in India also, this is increasingly becoming the case, because a lot of young people nowadays, they take loans for their flats or houses, for cars, because the mindset has changed. I mean, our generation thought taking a loan is such a bad idea. But nowadays, the young generation do not.
Taking a loan for our generation was like the last 15 minutes of a Minhal Sen movie. That's when everything has gone to hell and they're all dying. That's when they go for the loan.
So the new generation does not think so. So therefore, for them, the mortgage interest rate, the housing loan, these things have, the car loan interest rate, these things count much more than anything else. And also for many people, the fixed deposit interest rates, particularly for senior people, senior citizens who depend on interest income, etc., for survival, for them, those things are far more important than a slight reduction in tax rates here and there.
Okay. So let's move on now that we have exhausted, if we've flogged the budget enough. Let's move on to the next item for today, which is your book, Baba. You've written an autobiography. So tell us a little bit about the book. What is it about? And why should people buy it?
Yes.
Because that's the important thing.
Yes.
Yeah. We Bengalis are very, 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 we feel very embarrassed in promoting anything, especially if it's a book written about us. So that's like double promotion, promoting me and promoting the book. But please feel free. We're in 2020. So tell the audience why they should buy your book.
Okay. First, one correction. Perhaps this is not really an autobiography. Auto part is correct, yes, okay. because I am writing my own story. But it's not really biography in the sense that it's a chronological ordering of things. It's more like memoirs, yeah. It's more or less.
What's a memoir versus an autobiography?
Yeah, autobiography is almost like a chronology of events, that this is how you are born, and then the step-by-step kind of thing. But memoirs is more like a random recollection of certain things you remember, and which you consider to be important or interesting to your reader, so you really pick and choose those things.
I understand. Obviously, you're not going to read about his, me growing up and the problems of that. That's not in the book. So I'm pretty sure that occupied a lot of my father's, brain cycle. So with that respect, I'm thankful that it is not an autobiography and it is more a memoir, because that's for my autobiography. Okay, go on.
Okay, now, why should I write a book? I mean, everyone can write an autobiography.
Sure.
Say. So, well, frankly speaking, I too was not very sure or enthusiastic about writing it. But there was a little bit of insistence, you can say, from my wife, to some extent, Arnav also, and my daughter-in-law, because they know a little bit about where I came from originally, and then where I ended up with. I'm not saying that I've become a great man or anything like that. But still, you can say the kind of journey that I have undertaken in my life, I think this is an interesting story to write about. And maybe some people will be interested in knowing about this. Yes, some part of it is very typical, you can say. Most people of my generation had to go through. But something could be rather typical of me also. Okay, so that is what I have tried to do. But you could say the basic purpose is not so much to tell my story, but rather I've tried to capture as far as possible a bygone era, a time which has gone by, and young generation, and many of these things are almost not known to the current generation of people.
Like what?
Yes. Let's say the scarcity economy, for example. You see, when we were growing up, you see, there was a legacy of wartime controls, which continued for a long, long time. I mean, even though I was born in mid-1940s, right? So just immediately.
There were rules in what you can serve at a wedding and stuff, I remember. Yeah. You used to get wedding cards, which said according to the laws of...
While we were small boys, you see, everything means rice, kerosene, sugar, not to speak of watches, etc. But even this such basic things like rice, sugar, kerosene was in such short supply that you have to go to the ration shop every week in order to get your very inadequate amount of quota. Okay, so this is the kind of things that people accepted, that this is life. I mean, so the huge change has taken place as far as the present generation is concerned, because they will not be able to understand. The telephone was a luxury, and the quality of telephone service, I mean.
Yes, of course. I mean, I remember that. I'm not.
You remember that?
Yeah, so, I'm old enough to remember that part.
So there's been a huge change. Okay. Let me also give you one example, which is not in my childhood, but in another context. Even much later, when I went to the United States, you see, I was a lecturer at Calcutta University. I was just a junior lecturer. I just joined right after passing my MA exam, and I went to US within 2 years of that. I still remember my paycheck. It used to be 400 rupees per month. I still remember this is my first paycheck. Airfare, one-way airfare I'm talking about, was 4,000 rupees, which means 10 times my monthly salary. Now, just as compare this. Today, a university lecturer at the beginning point will be earning about 60,000 rupees. And one-way airfare would be roughly about the same, could be even less if you do a little bit of bargain hunting.
And buy it at once.
Yes. So less than 1 month's salary. So you can really, really, really know how much change has actually taken place. I mean, when we came here as graduate students, I was on full scholarship. Many of my friends, actually, in those days, unless you were a really rich person's son, only the people who were on full scholarships could even come to United States for higher studies. So I was one of those persons, I know. And there were quite a few friends of ours also who were coming from at least more affluent families. But even these people could not think of visiting their home before they could complete the prison. Not a single person of our friends went back to India even before the film, because they could not get enough money to buy the air ticket.
Yes.
Okay. So, but nowadays, the graduate students who come here, almost every year, they are going. So things have changed. And when I come to the United States,
phone calls were so expensive. Yes. Even I can remember when I came, phone calls were prohibitively expensive.
And most of our houses, they did not have any telephone, first of all. So, and it was terribly expensive. Both. And of course, internet, nothing was there. Computers are not there. It used to take 3 weeks for a letter to go from US to India, then another 2 weeks to come. So basically, we'll be lagging behind about 6 months, 6 weeks. I mean, there'll be a time gap between what you know about what your relatives are doing, etc. So that was the kind of life. I mean,
and plus you have Noxalism in your...
Yes, Noxalism is another...
That's such a hugely significant historic period of when my father was a college student. And that, I think, is gone into considerable detail in this book.
Yes.
Because of your connections and because of who your friends were.
Yes, yeah.
My father who his friends were. Let me repeat.
Yes. Yeah, actually, one of the, major Noxalite student leader, whose name was Osim Chatterjee, used to be known as Kaka, because Ho Chi Minh used to be called the uncle. Okay. Yeah. And, these Noxalites are so enamored of foreign things. That's as they used to say, the Chairman Mao is our chairman kind of thing. So they were
and Trump is not our president. Yes, go on.
Yeah. So what used to happen is that, and this Osim Chatterjee was one of my actually closest friends from my school days.
Yes.
And so he was my friend in school days, was also my friend at Presidency College and all that. So I was pretty good. As a matter of fact, even though I had strong difference of opinion with him. But you see, in police books, they entered my name also as an Noxalite because they have seen me with Osim Chatterjee.
Yes.
Yes.
So this is in those days before Facebook. This was the equivalent of you being added as a friend, of what would happen if an Noxalite guy added you as a friend on Facebook. This is what would happen.
How did I know? Because one time when my passport, I applied for a renewal of my passport, and for some reason it was being delayed and delayed and delayed. Now, I had one of my friend whose father was a senior police officer. So I asked Amitabh Bagchi, can you please inquire what is happening? I mean, they said that police verification is taking so much amount of time. And then his father inquired and said that your friend Alok Rai's name is in the police book as a Noxalite. So that's why they're taking so much amount of time. But eventually somehow it got sorted out. But you see, this is, so even by association, I mean, sometimes yes. You're speaking with somebody. So the so-called detectives are...
Of course. I mean, that this is not just something which the Calcutta police would do. Any police, any law enforcement agency in the world, yeah. If they were monitoring somebody like Ashim Chatterjee, they would keep a watch out on who he talks to. Yes, of course.
Yeah. Even though we're talking at coffee house, there are other people in the front of so many people, they are having heated discussion, but it doesn't matter.
Right? If you talk to that person more than once, they're keeping tabs on.
Anyway, so I have said quite a few things about the Presidency College those days. And
this is important because student politics is again at the forefront of our national affairs. So the last time it was at least to this level important across the nation was during Naxalism, and my father's book has a lot of that.
Yeah. But it's going a little bit back, you see. Another very interesting thing was this. That is my parents, you see, because even though I was brought up in a small village, remote village in undivided Bengal, our family was a bit different from
progressive
family. See, progressively, you see, because there are not very many people whose father was a revolutionary freedom fighter who was deported to Andaman Cellular Jail for life.
Yes. And for those of you who don't know that, the British sent the worst of the worst to Andaman. So this is not... This is not Nehru's jail, where he sits and writes a book and he has full access to a library. This is a place of hard labor, where people are kept in cages, not even fit for animals, and tortured day and night.
Yes.
This is that place where they send the worst. Which is always when they say Veer Savarkar asked for mercy.
Yeah, exactly.
Go to that place and see why.
Exactly.
Nehru would have asked for mercy too, if they had put him there for one day.
But at the same time, when I mentioned this to my elder brother, what the Veer Savarkar says, but my father did not do it. There are lots of other people who did not do it. So just by saying that Veer Savarkar did it because he was being tortured is neither here nor there.
Yes, that's true. A lot of people didn't do it. Didn't do it.
Yeah, and then a lot of people who actually even committed suicide there.
Yes.
So they could not bear the torture.
So this was the kind of place in general for exactly. people to know, because when people say that he asked for forgiveness, whatever it could have been, people don't know.
It was a real difficult
thing. What that place was. And like people used to commit suicide in order to escape the torture. It was that kind. So normally there was one thing about the British Raj, that the British Raj was normally seen as fair. If you look at all the other colonial powers, if you look at what the Belgians did, if you look at what the French did in Africa, you would normally, and again, this is a very, somebody says a callous comparison, to make the British were the most merciful among all the different imperialist powers.
Yes,
so one of the things was, they used to say that the British was like cricket, that the cricket thing, that there has to be some, it's not cricket, that there has to be some amount of fairness. And I've seen this written somewhere, that the other colonial powers, they did not have cricket. So cricket kind of encapsulated the British notion of there should be some fairness in life. Now, the Andaman and Nicobar Islands was that part of the British Empire which they were not proud about. This was like kind of their Guantanamo Bay. Like even America, yes. Right? They want to say we are very morals, we have human rights. But yeah, they also have Guantanamo Bay, where they basically say, no, not for this part. This part is a little different. And so, and even Obama, whose main one of his campaign promises that he would close down Guantanamo Bay, he never did. Because once they get into power, they realize why they need to keep that place. So this was, and again, people don't know this. And of course, nobody really cares to tell people, but this is again, one of the reasons why you should be reading this book is that these things are there. You know, you understand what the freedom fight, the struggle was. And freedom struggle is not exclusively what you read in the textbooks. It's not the story of Gandhi. It's not just the story of Nehru. It's not the story of Patel. It's not Chori Chora. It is these places which have not been given the appropriate amount of importance, and the people who were sent there and why they were sent to these places, because these people were not influential people also. Yes. My grandfather was not an influential people. He wasn't Motilal Nehru's son. He wasn't leading the Indian National Congress. There were other people whose names people have forgotten, to be honest, who did a lot, much more, who sacrificed much more than the people who we come to know in history books and whose children and grandchildren have been, you know, basically cashing in that for decades. But there are many people who we don't even know of, and this is what they did and what they went through.
And you should remember, my father is just a typical example. I'm sure there are lots of
yes, there are many.
Like yeah, so you can take it as one story out of so many other stories. But at least I'm telling at least one story. That you should remember that my father was the only son of a widow.
Yes,
you see, so the kind of sacrifice for the family, see, not only just for he was a good student. He was in college. He gave up everything and joined this freedom movement. He had two unwed sisters, and when he went to and sent to Andaman jail, my grandmother, he basically thought that this is the last time he's seeing his son. He'll never be able to see his only son,
her
son, in her lifetime. Okay. It so happened that my father was released after a few years because of this King George's coronation.
And the story which you should not tell here, because I want people to read the book of what happened when he came back.
Unannounced, is there,
and it's worth reading.
Yes. Yeah, worth reading. And there was some story about the communal situation also at that time. I mean, because I should just mention here, because this is also something very interesting. I'm not giving the details. You see, when we were small children, I mean, this is just immediately after partition. So the communal tension was very much in the air, and a lot of people had suffered tremendously during the partition. But you see, my father has just come back from the Andaman Cellular Jail. And then sometimes in the evening, some people would come rushing and tell my father that a communal riot has broken out in a nearby village. You see, my father alone.
Communal riot in those days? I thought the BJP caused this only.
No, of course not. The communal, I'm being sarcastic. Yes, communal riot. My father alone. There was another assistant of my father who Baba would take his bicycle, and that other chap will be his pillion rider. Baba alone would go to stop the communal riot. If my Baba got a little bit of time, he would go to the next village where there is another secular Muslim leader, Shahadat Ali, who is called Shahadat Kaka. He would take him, and then one Hindu and one Muslim will go and stop the communal riot. And we kids and Thakurma would actually be scared dead, so to say,
yes,
that whether
course.
My father will come back alive or not. But still, father would take that risk every time this thing used to happen. And father came back alive. But when I think of this kind of moral courage, but then I also wonder whether this kind of moral courage would have worked in today's India. When in this post-Godhra kind of situation, there was one member of parliament who had even a gun in his hand, and he was butchered by a marauding mob. I mean, so I don't know. So why I'm mentioning this is that I thought that, okay, those were the
periods. You're talking about Ehsan Jafri.
Yes. So those are the time immediately after partition. You see, there was this butchering all around and all that. But even after so many years, you see, the situation has not really improved. That is something which really pains me. The situation is actually getting worse and worse. I mean,
And I know you and I disagree on this, but you know, my opinion is that things will never improve because this is part and parcel of being human, that we will have communities and we will have violence based on that. And if you don't have violence, then there will be no community. So this is again, yeah, it's a topic for another day. But these are fascinating stories in this book, and I don't think that you get to hear these stories as often as you should. And as we conclude, I would just like to add my own pitch for this book. And it's why I feel this is a book that you should definitely read, especially if you like my podcast. And I know that I know the kind of target audience that listens to this podcast. It's not early 20s people who are listening to this podcast. It's mostly people my age. So this is particularly true of people who are in the early 20s, but also people of my age, we try to compare the condition of India nowadays to the world. And, you know, many of us have stayed in the US for a significant period of time. And we look at US and say, why aren't we more like the US? That's really the question that drives. So many of the base standards are set based on Western democracies and the US. Now, in order for you to understand what a crazy comparison that is, you have to read my father's story to understand where we were.
Yes.
Where we were, the fact that you're even having this conversation as to where Air India's business class is better than so-and-so's business class, even for us to even have that conversation, to understand where we came from, the kind of depredations and the kind of poverty, that when India was independent, when my father was a young man, the fact that many wise people thought that this country would not survive as a country, that it would pull itself asunder in essentially ethnic conflicts, and people would just turn on each other, and it would just be one gigantic, you know, human calamity. And that never happened to that extent. Yes, there was and always will be violence, as I say. There will always be communal violence. That's inevitable in a country of this level of diversity. And with the legacy of colonialism and what we inherited in 1947. But we might say so, but we often don't understand to the extent of where we were. And, you know, we get into this BJP versus Congress, but, you know, even if you have to understand, the greatest contribution of the Congress is bringing us in the first 2-3 decades of our existence as a country from that state, which you will read in my father's autobiography or memoirs, to where we are today. And this is a remarkable, remarkable achievement. To come, it's independence is an achievement, true, but coming from there to where we are today, that is an enormous achievement. And this is a personal, I mean, you can read about it in the history books, but there's also worth of reading it through the lens of one person who lived through it all. And again, that I'm not privy to that, so I'm privy to a different kind of generation and a different kind of struggle, but I haven't seen that thing. And I think that part of my father's autobiography is perhaps, for me, is the most fascinating, and it's no less than history.
In this context, let me also mention one thing. I mean, because this is something which I mentioned to many of my students at IIMC, when I'm teaching in America also, I sometimes mention about my primary school. You see, my primary school, my first school was, there are 4 classes, 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 2 rooms and there are 2 teachers. Okay? So one group of students would be sitting on one side of the wall, and in the opposite wall, there'll be class 1 would be sitting on this side, class 2 would be sitting, then another room, class 3 will be sitting on it. But still, we managed it, you see. Not only me. You see, why I'm mentioning is that from that same school has produced, say, high court judges, there are lots of doctors,
yes,
lots of well-known professors, and all that. So that's why I mention it to the students is that you people are so much, well, sir, AC is not working today, sir. How can I have class? And then I tell them the stories. And you see, you don't need many of these
things. So again, one of the things we love to talk about nowadays is privilege and, you know, merit versus privilege. And these conversations are important conversations to have. But, you know, once you read this book and you talk to my father, you realize that this very notion of privilege itself, I mean, what we consider, I mean, I tweeted a link where Alia Bhatt says that she's trying to live in a budget. And that meant that she has a house in London and one in Paris, and she's thinking of buying a private jet. That is living on a budget.
Her budget.
Her budget. So this is just like, it's the same for us when we say that, oh my God, the AC isn't working, or we're stuck in a traffic jam, or, you know, something else. You have to understand that the generation before, you know, how crazy this sounds. It exactly sounds to them like Alia Bhatt saying that, you know, I'm thinking of whether I should buy a private jet. It sounds exactly similarly silly. So again, I think it's important. I mean, it's important to read history, but it's also important to see history through the eyes of one person. And of course, it's through the eyes of one person. It's kind of biased, and it's kind of, you know, of course, it's one person's view of history, but it is history. And my father lived through, you know, a tremendous period of history. The change that happened in India, that was the point that I was trying to emphasize, is that the change that this country went through in those years, I don't think we're ever going to go through that level of change ever again.
And also, when I arrived in the US, I mean, what kind of awe?
Yes.
because the America in India, they were poles apart.
That even I remember in the 80s.
But still, I mean, the kind of standard in, you know, America was a rich country. How rich? How big a difference? Yeah, absolutely.
Roads.
Yeah. The first thing
is, you hit the roads. Yeah,
and I had $8 in my pocket when I landed at the airport. I thought that my friends would be there. There's nobody. And the $8 are not enough even to take me to the university. I didn't even know what the taxi fare is. I mean, so these are really, really interesting things. I mean, what we had to go through. I mean,
and true. And this is, again, for and I know many of my listeners here are Indians who have come to the U.S. to study or have come to the U.S. to work, either stayed on here and gone back. But, you know, this is a story of what it meant coming to the U.S. In those days where U.S. wasn't part of our lifestyle. My father didn't grow up seeing friends in the way that we did. So it was not just a question of $8, but also, you know, or the fact that the streets were so different. The fact that he'd never seen
I haven't seen a commode or a paper toilet. Yes. Nothing. I mean, everything is so new.
So this is like going to an alien world, actually, for us. So it's not that, you know, forget people who are young now. I'm not even considering them. But even us in the 90s, when we came here, we fairly knew pretty well what U.S. life was. We had grown up seeing Hollywood movies. We had grown up seeing Friends. There might be some things that we didn't know. Like, for instance, that we didn't know that you don't ask people for a rubber. You know, there are some things perhaps that we might not have known, but mostly we knew everything. And my father, when he came here, there was no internet, of course. There was no television. Television in that sense. He didn't grow up on Hollywood movies. So there was very little. And even Hollywood movies, what my father had seen would be cowboys, really. And that had nothing to do with, you know, urban New York.
Or one or two Marilyn Monroe movies.
So Marilyn Monroe, which again, it's like trying to form an idea of India after watching Karan Johar's movies, right? So this is a fairly unique, perspective on not just history in India, but that really real experience that so many of us in our generation, and I have done it, which is to come from, you know, go from India to the U.S. So with that, I would again, you know, the book is available on Amazon. It's available in physical copy now, and it's available on Kindle worldwide. And for the last thing, for the last item, hold on, Vikram. I'll get my daughter who wants to congratulate my father. My daughter Anahita is here. All right, Anahita, you want to say something about your Dadu's book?
Congratulations, Dadu! I hope your book comes out and everyone will read it. Even I want to get a copy as soon as I can.
And will you tell people whose name is on the front page and the story behind that dedication?
Oh, sure, yeah. And I also want to tell Dadu that I want everyone to know that he's a famous Arnold Gray writer, although he's so far only written one book.
two books, whatever. But do you want to talk about the opening dedication page, which is dedicated to... Stories, it's dedicated to you, right? So why don't you tell people that? They might not know who you are.
Okay, my name is Anahita.
Yes, and the book
is dedicated to me from my grandpa, Alok Ray, like I said before. And the dedication page is dedicated to me.
Return for the stories, remember?
Something. Well, anyway, congratulations.
Okay. It says that you always ask me for stories, so here is my story for you.
Oh, yeah, and I also want to hear some other funny stories, like the one that when your dad was doing the play and then you shoved and when you were backstage and you pulled the trigger,
all those things are there.
All the stories are there.
Village theaters and all that.
Yeah. Village theaters. That's what my daughter is talking about. Okay, so thanks a lot, everybody, for listening. And again, the book is out on Kindle for those of you who want to read it electronically, and the physical copies are available on Amazon.
Absolutely. So that's our podcast for today. And the book is, of course, called My Life, The Story of Another Appu, and available along with Arnab's books and no doubt someday Anahita's books also. And while we are talking, let's also remind you of the Patreon page. That's at patreon.com/greatbong, where you can pledge and contribute to Arnab to show your appreciation for this podcast. So until next time, take care. Bye-bye.